about 12 years after Ronald Reagan himself. So he had obviously been suffering from Alzheimer's a long time, but I think it is the passing of a other than, kind of a legend, really. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a legend. His wife was a legend. And I think it is terribly sad that we've lost her. It's amazing that she made it so long after Ronald Reagan died. So 94 years old, she had been a Hollywood actress. And so maybe that is a good background for a president. I don't know. But I've got a little clip here for you on that. But I think she was highly regarded. She was put down like by a lot of people for being a dragon lady and that type of thing. But I think that she was a very effective spouse and certainly beloved by the president. Check this out. This is from Fox News. And here we go.
Named Nancy was born in New York City on July 6, 1921. Her parents, Kenneth and Edie, divorced soon afterwards, and she was raised by her mother, an actress, and had little contact with her father. In 1929, Edie married Dr. Loyal Davis, moving the family to Chicago.
She had a stepfather that she was extremely fond of.
I'm not getting a lot of sound out of this, so let me switch over to the one from CNN. Here we go.
Many of you may be thinking, well, drugs don't concern me, but it does concern you. It concerns us all because of the way it tears at our lives and because it's aimed at destroying the brightness and life of the sons and daughters of the United States. For 5 years, I've been traveling across the country, learning and listening, and one of the most hopeful signs I've seen is the building of an essential new awareness of how terrible and threatening drug abuse is to our society. This was one of the main purposes when I started, so of course it makes me happy that that's been accomplished. But each time I meet with someone new or receive another letter from a troubled person on drugs, I yearn to find a way to help share the message that cries out from them. As a parent, I'm especially concerned about what drugs are doing to young mothers and their newborn children. Listen to this news account from a hospital in Florida of a child born to a mother with a cocaine habit. Nearby, a baby named Paul lies motionless in an incubator, feeding tubes riddling his tiny body. He needs a respirator to breathe and a daily spinal tap to relieve fluid buildup on his brain. Only 1 month old, he's already suffered 2 strokes. Now you can see why drug abuse concerns every one of us, all the American family. Drugs steal away so much. They take and take.
And this is her Just Say No campaign, so obviously that is one of her legacies. And so anyway, she, Nancy Reagan was somebody who was, I think, a pretty good sounding board for her husband and stuff. She got, there was a few lighter moments that supposedly she did things like, get into psychics or whatever. But I mean, I think that she's probably a person that was, instrumental in the president becoming who he became today, who we know him as. And I think that I don't think that his wife, Jane Wyman, who was the Academy Award winning actress that he was first married to, I don't think that he was, I don't think she was really interested in politics, from what I understand. And I, from the story that I've heard, she had, when she won the Academy Award, came home and told him that she was going to divorce him. So she perhaps felt like she had gone beyond him as a performer or whatever. And apparently he never really got over the rejection and everything. So I think that when he met Nancy, she was more of a, you know, she wasn't really in competition with him. She was a support of him, you know, obviously a beautiful young actress when he married her. And then they put a family together, and then she became a support for him. And that probably doesn't happen if he stays with, even if he and Jane Wyman don't get divorced. So anyway, here is a little bit from NBC News.
When she met Ronald Reagan on the MGM lot in 1949, he was already a star. But though she had her own Hollywood dreams, she later said she found her greatest role as his wife.
I think I was born to be married. I was the happiest girl in the world when I became we.
They married in 1952, a simple ceremony, and even appeared together in Hellcats of the Navy, the last of her 11 films.
I began to think maybe you were playing the South Sea Circus.
You knew better.
How could I know? Did you give me a post-dated check?
From then on, by her own description, her life was devoted to her husband, as mother to their two children, Patty and Ron, and as stepmother to his two children by former wife Jane Wyman. Then came politics and her long career as a first lady, first in California to Governor Ronald Reagan in 1966.
What's Ronnie's greatest asset for the women voters?
Why? Just in Ronnie, I guess.
And then to President Reagan in 1980. After the president was shot by a would-be assassin just 2 months into his first term, his wife was forever shaken.
Every time he went out and talked to thousands of people, my heart stopped.
But she carried on, steadfast in her chosen roles as the president's protector, best friend, and partner in efforts like the anti-drug campaign for which she was forever linked.
When it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
She was criticized for consulting an astrologer about the president's schedule, dubbed Queen Nancy for her expensive tastes in fashion and White House decor, and accused of managing her husband.
Doing everything we can.
But the fact is, she never wavered as a loving wife in all the ways she knew. And when in the mid-90s, the then former president revealed he'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, the partner who would rarely leave his side visited the Republican National Convention to share her family's pain and a new cause.
We learned, as too many other families have learned, of the terrible pain and loneliness that must be endured as each day brings another reminder of this very long goodbye.
So, Nancy, let me say thank you for all you do. Thank you for your love. And thank you for just being you.
She stayed close to her Ronnie even in her last years. She made it a point to be there when the Reagan Library hosted election year debates and to visit her husband's resting place, a love story to the very end. Lester Holt, NBC News.
So anyway, sad, I think,
NBC's Tom Brokaw. Tom, given all the time that you spent helming NBC Nightly News and your coverage of so many things, domestic and international, put this into perspective, the life of Nancy Reagan, and your first thought when you heard about her passing today.
Well, I was unsettled more in a way than I thought I might have been, because I've been concerned that she was near the end. In fact, I just talked to her on February 6th.
There was something about the way that Reagan had, I don't know, there was something special about Reagan, because he was a person who had, a lot of patriotism in him. He was not a person, for example, who would get up and go to another country and apologize, bow down to emperors or kings or whatever, presidents. He was a person who did whatever he knew how to do to protect America. He wasn't a perfect man and such, but in his approach to being president, he was never embarrassed of our country. He was never overly critical of America's past or mission in the world. And that would be something nice to have these days, you know, as someone who was a fan of America instead of someone who seems like a critic. So anyway, we'll come back and I'll have a little bit of a speech of Reagan when we come back. But I think that, you know, that we've seen that leadership makes all the difference in the world. I don't know what else to say about that. You know, it's pretty obvious that who is leading you has got the, you know, their spirit, their intent is a huge part in whether your country is going to make it. And so what makes this particular race that we're in so important now is the fact that we need a change of leadership. We need a change of leadership style, in my opinion. And whether that's through Trump or Cruz or whoever else would come in, I think that we can't continue to go down the road we're in, or we're going to go down the drain. Kelly O'Connell, 619 AM, Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523, 1450. We'll be right back. Here's a little bit more on Nancy Reagan, who just passed away, from NBC News.
Spent helming NBC Nightly News and in your coverage of so many things, domestic and international. Put this into perspective, the life of Nancy Reagan, and your first thoughts when you heard about her passing today.
Well, I was unsettled more in a way than I thought I might have been, because I've been concerned that she was near the end. In fact, I just talked to her on February 6th. The president and I shared a birthday, so every year Nancy and I would exchange notes.
This is Tom Brokaw, by the way, former anchor at NBC.
And a phone call. And Jim Baker and I were together, and we called her, and she was very alert. She very responsive to what we had to say. When I saw her last summer in Los Angeles, I was quite concerned. We couldn't see her until late in the afternoon. She was not as responsive. She was very pulled together in terms of her appearance and everything, and we spent about an hour with her. So I have been waiting for this news in a matter of speaking, but I've spent a lot of my life with Nancy Reagan. I was a young reporter in 1966 in Los Angeles, having just arrived to go to work for the network, when he began to run for governor. Obviously, she was an important part of that first campaign and all the others that followed. So I came to know her as a reporter and as a woman who was going to be the wife of the governor of the state of California initially. And she was very protective of him then, and came out of that kind of higher caste Los Angeles Film Society. They had a lot of important, very wealthy friends. It came to be known as the Kitchen Cabinet, Holmes Tuttle, a big auto dealer, and Alfred Bloomingdale and others. And she had a very certain idea about how she wanted to live her life and how she wanted to protect my Ronnie, as she called him.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very funny experience with her when they were getting ready to run for re-election. I was at the press club in Los Angeles, and I was sitting at the end of a table. By then, I kind of knew everybody, and Nancy came in, and she was giving little kisses to everybody standing there. And as I remember, there were people like Jimmy Stewart and Gloria Stewart, and their friends from the old Hollywood days. And she got all the way around the rim. She wasn't looking up, and she leaned over to kiss me. And kind of startling, she leaned back, and I said, "Oh, Mrs. Reagan, whatever it is I have, it's not catching." And we laughed, and she leaned over and gave me a kiss and kind of a high five. That was Nancy. She was so adept at any kind of public appearance and making a recovery. And as Andrea said earlier, I thought she was one of the two or three most important political advisors that he had, not just during his days in California, but certainly when he was in the White House. Very protective of him. But she also encouraged him to make the deal with the Soviet Union, not just on their terms, but on our terms. She could see, having talked to Jim Baker and George Shultz and the others, the opportunity to do something truly historic.
And Tom, to that end, her footprint, if you will, within the Reagan White House years, that which you're talking about, Chuck and Andrea, and her influence, that was obvious, that was known. Was it as much so during her years as First Lady of California?
I think it did help. And of course, there is a kind of aristocracy about Hollywood as well. And they were among the first couples of Hollywood. By the time I got to know them, by the time he was getting ready to run for governor, his film career had peaked. But he was extremely well known around the country as a spokesman for General Electric. He made speeches. I used to, when I was working in Omaha, he would come through there, and you could see the transition from being a 1940s liberal to being a 1950s and 60s conservative. And within the Los Angeles society, they were highly regarded, and they had their own set. And she had a very strong sense of who she was, what was appropriate. And I always thought that she carried herself with great dignity. Now she.
All right. So Nancy Reagan passing on, and I don't know. It's very sad, you know, to be totally honest. Here's a little. I think we have a little bit more here. From this clip, I think this is a pretty good interview with Tom Brokaw. Nancy Reagan came under a lot of scrutiny and was made fun of quite a bit for various reasons, that she was wooden, that she was kind of a dragon lady, that she controlled everything. But I think she is an example of of an individual who, without being a feminist, without trying to have her own career, exerted enormous power over the history of the United States. There is more than one way to power. I think a woman does not necessarily have to be a feminist to influence. Here is another clip from that same page on NBC News.
Remarkable chapters in American political history ended sadly today with word of the death of Nancy Reagan. She was, of course, first lady to her husband, President Ronald Reagan, but so much more. The depth of her devotion toward the president built her an unrivaled level of political influence. Nancy Reagan died of congestive heart failure in Los Angeles today at the age of 94. In a statement, the president and Mrs. Obama extended their condolences, saying, "We were fortunate to benefit from her proud example and her warm and generous advice." Nancy Reagan's public journey began on the silver screen and ended in the White House. Nancy Davis was an actress herself when she met Ronald Reagan on the MGM lot in 1949. He was already a star.
Did we already listen to this? Anyway, let's take a break here, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to play a little clip from one of Reagan's speeches, 6:29. And then we've got a lot to talk about in terms of the race, the Democratic debate, and what has happened on Super Saturday. Kelly O'Connell, 6:30 a.m. Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523 1450. We'll be right back.
Whoa, beautiful. For heroes proved in liberating strife.
All right, so this topic of Nancy Reagan brings up to mind a conversation that I was having with a person about feminism. And do you consider Nancy to have been a feminist if you remember her? And, you know, it seems like I did a show on feminism, or I tried to, and nobody even responded. But if you go out to YouTube, it's only criticism of feminism. You don't really see, yeah, there's a few souls on there defending feminism, but I think it is a discredited theory in popular, at some level in popular society, but I think it is an extremely formidable and influential set of ideas that has been largely accepted. And, you know, that women have their own career. They have a duty to follow, to develop their talent and to follow their career. And that when they get married, men need to understand that they are an equal partner, and that they family is going to have to make sacrifices, similar sacrifices for the man and the woman. If she gives birth, if they decide to have children, then those children will probably, if she is devoted to her career, a working feminist, will put those children into child care, and then they will be raised largely by the school system. And you might disagree with part of that, but I would say that that's largely the model for families in the United States. And, you know, one of these days soon, let's have a conversation about this, whether this is a healthy thing, whether it could be changed even if we wanted to, you know, whether it is beneficial for children and everything. But anyway, I see Nancy Reagan as a person who set aside her own career and helped Reagan. I don't think Reagan could have made it on his own, you know. Now, I don't even claim to understand what goes on with Obama and his spouse. There's been a lot of derogatory things said about his wife, but it may be, maybe it's the same exact thing. I don't know. But anyway, here is a little, just to remind us of who Ronald Reagan was. Here's a speech, a little bit from a speech called A Time for Choosing.
Those who would trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they have a utopian solution, a peace without victory. They call their policy accommodation. And they say if we'll only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll forget his evil ways and learn to love us. All who oppose them are indicted as warmongers. They say we offer simple answers to complex problems. Well, perhaps there is a simple answer. Not an easy answer, but simple. If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, we cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Now let's set the record straight. There's no argument over the choice between peace and war, but there's only one guaranteed way you can have peace, and you can have it in the next second. Surrender. Admittedly, there's a risk in any course we follow other than this, but every lesson of history tells us that the greater risk lies in appeasement. And this is the specter our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to face, that their policy of accommodation is appeasement. And it gives no choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. If we continue to accommodate, continue to back and retreat, eventually we have to face the final demand, the ultimatum. And what then? When Nikita Khrushchev has told his people, he knows what our answer will be. He has told them that we're retreating under the pressure of the Cold War, and someday, when the time comes to deliver the final ultimatum, our surrender will be voluntary, because by that time, we will have been weakened from within spiritually, morally, and economically. He believes this because from our side, he's heard voices pleading for peace at any price, or better rev than dead, or as one commentator put it, he'd rather live on his knees than die on his feet. And therein lies the road to war, because those voices don't speak for the rest of us. You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance. This is the meaning in the phrase of Barry Goldwater, peace through strength. Winston Churchill said, the destiny of man is not measured by material computations. When great forces are on the move in the world, we learn we're spirits, not animals. And he said, there's something going on in time and space and beyond time and space, which, whether we like it or not, spells duty. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. We will keep in mind and remember that Barry Goldwater has faith in us. He has faith that you and I have the ability and the dignity and the right to make our own decisions and determine our own destiny. Thank you very much.
That was the end of a speech called The Time for Choosing, and was for the nomination of Barry Goldwater. As a matter of fact, it's funny, I just, before Nancy died, picked up a copy of Goldwater's book, his famous book, and have been reading it, and it's very powerfully written. It struck me as how timely it was, the things that he was talking about and the way he was putting them. For example, he was talking about the fact that most people saw some level of value in conservative economics, you know, not overspending and that type of thing. But he said a lot of conservatives will apologize for being unfeeling and all this stuff. And he said that our movement is not unfeeling at all. So I might make a few marks in the book and bring it in. I was told you I was trying to figure out how to bring a few book reports on the show. Kelly O'Connell, 642. Here is A Little More America, the Beautiful, in honor of Nancy Reagan. We'll give you some weather here when we're back in just a moment.
The following pre-recorded political program is...
You know, there's something called the Pineapple Express. It is this warm river of air that's coming across the Pacific Ocean, and it's hitting California right now, and they're getting wave after wave of rain, and also they're supposed to get up to 5 feet of snow up in the Sierra Nevadas. But it's not one big storm, but it's storm after storm, and they're referring to it as the basically, one guy called it a river in the sky. There's so much moisture in it. So that is going to affect us a little bit as well. Here's a few one-liners from Reagan, Ronald Reagan.
30th, 1981. John Hinckley Jr. fires 6 shots at President Ronald Reagan. A bullet lodges an inch away from his heart. Reagan is rushed into the operating room and tells his doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans."
Presenting to you the President of the United States.
Our 40th president survived, of course. Besides his toughness, the shooting showed the American people that the great communicator also had quite a sense of humor.
Letter came from Peter Sweeney. He's in the second grade in the Riverside School in Rockville Center. And he said, "I hope you get well quick, or you might have to make a speech in your pajamas."
Throughout his political career, Reagan used humor to win friends, influence voters.
You already are the oldest president in history.
And slay the opposition. No one knew that better than Democratic challenger Walter Mondale.
"I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience."
"You wanted law and order in this town. You've got it."
A former Hollywood actor and spokesman for General Electric, Reagan knew how to make his humor seem off the cuff, except that it wasn't.
"Mike Devers, in his book, said that I had a short attention span. Well, I was going to reply to that, but what the hell, let's move on to something else."
You know, you could talk to any number of President Reagan's speechwriters over the years, and when they might hand him a speech, sometimes the speeches would come back with a quote or an expression or a joke that they hadn't seen before.
Turns out the Gipper had a secret comedic weapon, says John Highbush, executive director of the Reagan Library.
"So all of this is the contents of his desk, the last desk he used.
2 boxes filled with the last objects sitting inside President Reagan's working desk."
"Cool. All right, well, listen, I want to see this stuff."
Buried inside one of these boxes,
a stack of index cards.
The president's famous one-liners, his best jokes, written on both sides. You know, this is the humor of Ronald Reagan in 3x5.
This one is titled One-Liners. Adolescence is the time when children suddenly feel responsible for answering the phone. Pretty good. It's funny. As unassuming as these look, they were political dynamite, a war chest of jokes. Many he wrote himself, others he borrowed.
Someone has once said that actually, as long as there are final exams, there will be prayer in school.
I can remember when a hot story broke and the reporters would run in yelling, "Stop the chisels."
We showed some of the jokes to comedian Drew Carey. Jokes about Congress.
I've wondered at times what the Ten Commandments would have looked like if Moses had run them to the U.S. Congress.
About the Soviet Union.
What are the four things wrong with Soviet agriculture? Spring, summer, autumn, and winter.
And about himself.
Just to show you the best one.
Just to show you how youthful I am, I intend to campaign in all 13 states.
He was a guy who wasn't afraid to make fun of himself, which was great. You know, like, whatever you think the elephant in the room is, that's the thing you should be able to talk about and joke about. And I do the same thing. The first thing I do is I make a joke about the way I look.
And that kind of inoculates yourself.
Totally.
When I go in for a physical now, they no longer ask me how old I am. They just carbon date me.
Reagan's sunny disposition, his ability to joke about pretty much anything, long predated his career in politics, says his daughter, Patty Davis. She says it was a lifelong coping mechanism.
I think that everything about my father goes back to the fact of him being the child of an alcoholic. He protected himself against the unpredictability of his home by developing this sort of coating of humor over everything. I don't want to feel the pain here. I don't want to feel the unpredictability here.
Mr. President, in talking about the continuing recession tonight, you have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
At home, Davis also saw another side of her father's humor.
The reason that we made it a masked dance was
impersonating the distinctive, high-pitched voice of writer Truman Capote.
Idea of the domino, black and white idea.
So I'm trying to imagine Ronald Reagan imitating Truman Capote.
Yeah, and he wasn't doing it as a put-down, but to me, because I was so idealistic, you know, I thought, oh, this could be, you know, it's like he's putting down, you know, a gay man or something. He really wasn't. He just thought it was funny.
Oh, and there's one more Reagan family joke. After that assassination attempt, the Gipper told Nancy, "Honey, I forgot to duck."
Anyway, a little humor from Reagan there. And take a little break here and come back and finish up the first hour. But we've got a lot to talk about, which is the vote over the weekend and the Democratic debate, which got a little bit nasty. And actually, you know, the Democrat, Sanders, won more than Hillary did. So, interesting enough. We'll be right back. 650 AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450. Call in. Give your opinion.
The soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they...
Thank you. here is a little clip of Reagan on the Johnny Carson show. I think this might have been right after he became governor of California.
Nice to see you.
Nice to be here, John. Nice of you to have me here after a little more than 2 months unemployment.
That's right. How does it feel to be, well, you're not really unemployed now, because I know you're doing a syndicated column, and for many news, there are around 120 papers, I think. And
actually, I think this might have been right after he finished being governor, but anyway.
A radio show and on the lecture tour, but how does it feel to be, I don't know if they use the word temporarily out of politics or not, but we'll get into that later.
There's mixed emotions when you step down. There's always things that you had left undone that you'd like to have done. But then all of a sudden the curtain's pulled and that chapter's over and
somebody else takes over.
Yeah.
Did you have any major disappointments? What would you like to have done, or your biggest disappointment, maybe your biggest highlight in office as you look back on it?
Well, I'll start with the biggest highlight. The first of all, was proving that some things I'd long believed as a citizen would work, that you could introduce common sense in government, and after the first traumatic shock, you kind of made some of it work. I still say that the answer to our problems in this country, even at the national level, is to have a law that says there is a percentage limit of the people's earnings that government cannot go beyond without the consent of the people.
Just on that note, they've done studies and found out that there is a percentage of taxation, of income tax, that after you pass it, people start to hide income. And you know what it is? 17%.
Well, you're talking about the gross income of the country and how much they can appropriate for federal projects.
See, when you and I were boys back in the Midwest,
right,
governments, federal, state, and local, were only taking about 15 cents out of every dollar earned. Today, they're taking almost half of every dollar earned in the United States. And most people don't realize it because the taxes are hidden in the so-called business taxes. You know, the politician that stands up and yells, oh, let's save the little man, let's tax business. And everybody yells, hooray. They haven't figured out that every tax on business is just a part of the cost of production. And the customer winds up paying it when he buys the product. It's a hidden sales tax. There's 116 of them in the suit of clothes that each one of us is wearing.
Suppose a lot of economists have suggested, and I don't know that it'll ever come to be in this country, that if they closed all of the loopholes and corporations and maybe tax loopholes and even on the rich certain loopholes and made a percentage income and made a flat fee without all of the deductions, that the government might raise as much money as they do now.
Oh, sure. And really, the loopholes, this has been overdone by the politicians, too.
No.
The bulk of the money that is taken by what are called loopholes are the legitimate deductions with which the people didn't have them. They couldn't pay their income tax. Interest on their mortgage, interest on the installments on their car, their property taxes on their home, if they have one, and so forth. These are, in politicians' eyes, loopholes. But we ought to have tax reform, and we ought to start by making it so simple that you don't have to hire a lawyer to find out how much you owe every year.
That's for sure. It used to be a little simplified, but not anymore.
Johnny, we live in the only country in the world where it takes more brains to figure out your income tax than it does to earn the income.
That'd be right. You hear intelligent people from both political parties or in the middle, conservatives and liberals, and they all seem to have different answers as to what is going wrong in the country. Some people say, well, let's let the government spend billions of dollars. And then other people say, no more federal spending. Let's give the tax rebates. And the other intelligent people say, no tax rebates. We've got to do this and do that. So everybody is confused. How do you see the thing? How are we going to get out of this?
Well, Johnny, I think that one of the things is that people keep looking to government for the answer, and government's the problem. A moment ago, you asked, you know, about people and feeling not only confused, but low and down in America. First of all, the American people, if they would just take a little inventory and look around, you triple our troubles and we're better off than any other people on earth. And we've asked so much of government, and we've gotten in the habit over the last 40 years of thinking that government has the answers, There's very little that government can do as efficiently and as economically as the people can do themselves. And if government would shut the doors and sneak away for about 3 weeks, we'd never miss them. Now, if...
All right, so that's Reagan, just on Johnny Carson. He's pretty a pretty compelling figure to listen to. Speaking of which, you've been listening to AM Las Cruces on 1450 KOBE. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 to call in on the next hour. And mourning the passing of Nancy Reagan, the very, very influential spouse of Ronald Reagan. And we'll be right back and come back and talk about the race over the weekend and the Democratic debate, among some other things. Be right back. Hello, it's Kelly.
Hello, Kelly. My name is Victor, and I'm from Las Cruces. I know you don't have that much more time before you have to go back on the air after the CBS season. And I just have a really quick legal question, just very basic legal question. Is that okay, please?
Sure. I mean,
okay. This is very basic. My brother is the TTE of my dad's estate. I have two other siblings besides myself.
Victor, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Do me a favor, call my office. This is a very inconvenient time to answer something. I don't want to screw up the answer.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Okay.
Just call my office.
I cannot afford to pay much in terms of consultation fees or anything like that, sir.
Victor, just call my office, okay?
How much did you charge me to have a consultation with you over the phone?
Victor, just call my office, okay? I can't take this right now. Thank you. It is Kelly here, 706. Good morning to you. Hey, listen, if you have a need for legal advice, it is probably best for you to call me in my office. 805-1245 is one of the numbers. I have about five different numbers, but I cannot really give advice over if you call in on a break and you have a complicated legal problem. There's a couple of reasons I'm reluctant to give anything, advice. There's number one, and it doesn't really have anything to do with making money or anything like that. In a 2-minute stopgap on the air, you tell me 30 seconds or 1 minute facts about your situation. How can I possibly do you justice it's pretty obvious that it would be better if, sometimes people can't afford an attorney or they don't want to afford an attorney. And I understand that attorneys tend to be expensive. But do yourself a favor and go in and talk to an attorney in person. And I know a lot of great attorneys in town. And I have to tell you, having practiced in the field of law for quite a while now, some of the best people I've ever met are attorneys, believe it or not. And you wouldn't believe the stuff that attorneys have to go through to do their job. I'm not complaining, of course, but it's much more than meets the eye. And it's just like any of these professions, being a doctor, that type of thing. There's a lot more to it than you would ever imagine. And a lot of it is negative, which is why I think the suicide rate is the highest in the the legal profession, or it's one of them. In any event, I'm not suicidal or anything, but if you want some advice from an attorney, go into the office. Don't stop them at the post office. Don't, you know, a call up. Somebody just called up, which I don't resent this in the least, but I mean, if you've got a serious situation, you know, and you need some legal advice, give yourself the opportunity for the attorney to listen to the situation, and the attorney is going to hear things in your situation that you never realized or never thought of. Of course, you know, it's like going into the doctor. I've got these four symptoms. You're just going to think of 10 or 20 diseases probably. So in any event, most of the attorneys that I know help people at either discounted or sometimes do free cases, but it is the attorney that's going to decide whether it's a free case. It's not the person's occasionally, and all attorneys will get calls from people where the conversation starts off, do you do pro bono work, which is for free, no charge. No attorney wants to start off a conversation that way. The attorney wants to decide whether he or she is going to do free work. Maybe the case is an important one. Maybe the person has no money, whatever it is. But, you know, I mean, give yourself the opportunity to get good advice. If you've got a situation that you don't know, if you need an attorney, go talk to an attorney. Kelly, what if the attorney charges a consultation fee? Some attorneys in town don't do that. So if you have zero money, or if you are committed to the idea that you need or deserve free legal advice, then call around and you will be able to find somebody who gives a free consultation. But take the time to go in and find an attorney that specializes in your, don't go to a criminal attorney and think that you're going to get the latest up-to-date information on bankruptcy, for example. But, I mean, I know pretty much every attorney in town, and as a group of people, they are remarkably kind and polite individuals who are breaking their back, and there's a ton of work to be done. And I know attorneys that work every Saturday, and some attorneys, I think this is ill-advised, work 7 days a week, but the work never, you know, the labors never cease. When you hire an attorney, we should do a whole show on law and attorneys, but I would, here's one way to not get on the bad footing with your attorney. Don't call up your attorney and tell him that he's done nothing for you. Call up and ask, or talk to the assistant, you know, and by all means, don't stop by the office without an appointment, which that for some reason happens to me all the time. I can't figure it out, but I guess people say that I come across as accommodating and nice and everything, and so people kind of take it for granted they can just show up and talk. But really, you've got your day set up already between consultations, doing legal research and writing and showing up to court. There's really not – I mean, can you imagine showing up to a surgeon's office and expecting him to put aside a surgery so he can talk to you for an hour? Anyway, be that as it may, if you have a legal question in your life, there's probably a good chance that there's a lot riding on it. Do yourself a favor and call up an attorney, because it could quite possibly change the entire course of your life. I've seen many, many cases where people have come to me after the fact and said, this happened to me in court. And I said, well, why didn't you go get an attorney? And they say, well, I thought I could do it myself. or I couldn't afford it, or whatever. When you tell yourself that you can't afford an attorney, a lot of times you can't afford to not have an attorney, because all of these hearings and all of the stuff that attorneys do that might just seem like they are just, you know, just things that would happen in court that, you know, you have to go through A, B, C, and D. Those things are actually chock full of opportunities for attorneys to advocate for you, for them to get information, for them to begin to work on the DA for a plea bargain, this type of thing. So anyway, I don't talk about the law a lot on my show. It's not a legal show, but I think I'm going to start doing some legal shows, because I get a lot of people asking me basic questions. Anyway, so 7:13, and here's a little bit on your weather.
Last week we were talking severe weather in the south, and this week we're not only talking severe weather, but also a big flooding concern for this week. So we are going to have severe weather on tap tonight, tomorrow, really through the first part of the week. So we're still looking down to the south for severe weather to come through with this line that races through. So tonight, right into tomorrow, severe weather likely through the Texas area. By Tuesday and Tuesday night, we'll still...
Just to let you know, this map goes across the entire state of Texas, except down in the El Paso area and below that down to West Texas. But it goes up through the panhandle, through Amarillo, into New Mexico, and then well above Texas.
See the threat of severe storms mainly through Texas, and it will start to push to the east as we head through the middle of the week. But a lot of rainfall is expected with this. So this is rainfall right through the entire week. And right around the Texarkana area, we could see up to a foot of rain. The highest threat for flooding in the south is going to come Wednesday.
All right, so that is just in the center of the country, and then we've got another threat coming through the Pacific Northwest, through Southwest,
and Oregon.
I think this is this one is from San Francisco.
This is video of one of two surfers that had to be rescued in North Bend, Oregon, this weekend. It has certainly been a rough ride along the Pacific Northwest and Southwest with all this rain coming in. The winds have been howling. We've seen mudslides this weekend, and unfortunately, more of that's on tap for this week. We're going to see another storm system after storm system come in through the week, and we're not only looking at a lot of rainfall, but we could see feet of snow in the higher elevations. Rain, though, will be a big problem. Now, this is what expected rainfall through the bulk of this coming week, 5 to 8 inches, that will be the jackpot you see there in orange between Eureka and San Francisco. In that general area, we'll see a widespread 3 to 5. So more of this is on the way. Flooding will definitely be a big concern by next weekend.
Now, over the weekend on Saturday in San Francisco International Airport, they reported they had 1.5 inches in one day, which is a record. So in a 24-hour period, so absolutely amazing. All right, we'll take a break here and come back and talk about this election, what happened over the weekend. 7:16 and the possibility of a brokered convention. 7:16, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450. We'll be right back.
When I was in school, you know, we used to sing something like this. Oh, oh, spacious sky.
All right, so there was a Super Saturday. There were four races for the GOP. I think there was two for the Democrats. Trump and Cruz split it. Cruz ended up getting a couple of more, 10 or 15 more delegates. But as each race goes on, if the dynamic doesn't change, Trump is going to end up winning. Now, here's a little bit on Super Saturday from Fox.
Hi, friends. Good morning. It was a Super Saturday split. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz each claiming two victories in four GOP state contests. And now they have one message to Marco Rubio.
I would love to take on Ted one-on-one. That would be so much fun because Ted can't win New York. He can't win New Jersey. He can't win Pennsylvania. He can't win California. I want Ted one-on-one.
If you're a supporter right now of Marco Rubio and John Kasich, both good, honorable men, both men I respect. But if you don't want to see Donald Trump as the nominee, then I invite you to join our team.
So is this now officially a two-man race? Let's ask Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace joining us now. Hey there. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hey,
so guys.
What does your gut tell you on this, and what does math tell you on this?
Well, it's not officially a two-man race. Obviously, Rubio and Kasich are still staying in the race, and I suspect they will at least through a week till Tuesday.
I believe, by the way, that the reason that Kasich and Rubio are staying in the race is they are hoping for a brokered convention in which they will either be chosen as the leader of the party for the general election or to be a kingmaker.
When their home states come up, Florida in the case of Rubio, Ohio in the case of Kasich, but you know, look, you just got to look at the math, as you pointed out, and they had bad nights. Rubio had 3/3 and a fourth. Kasich had 3/4 and a third. At this point, you know, they can stay in the race as long as they want, but it's harder and harder to see a credible path for them to win the nomination.
Right,
it is looking more and more like Trump and Cruz.
Chris, do you get the sense that the donors in Washington, the establishment such as it is in Washington, is still planning on trying to impose on the Republican Party a nominee who didn't win the majority of delegates?
Well, I don't know that they can do that. I certainly think they're unhappy with the choice of Cruz and Trump. There's no question about that. They don't like Trump. They feel that, you know, for all the obvious reasons that he is running against the establishment. He certainly would be an unprecedented and very unusual Republican nominee. And Ted Cruz has made kind of a career out of thumbing his nose and to a certain degree irritating the Washington establishment. So this would be a choice between the lesser of two evils for the Washington establishment. And can they stop it? If it gets to be a two-man race, it becomes almost impossible because just the math, one gets more than 50%, the other one gets less than 50%.
Speaking of the establishment, you've got a jam-packed show this morning. Mitt Romney, whose speech this week, I don't know if we know whether, you know, what kind of an impact it had yet on last night's Super Saturday caucuses up in Maine particularly. What are you going to be talking to Mitt Romney about? Whether or not
that's certainly one of the questions is exactly that, is does he think the fact that Trump, who was favored to sweep all four and ended up losing two of the four contests in Kansas and Maine, does he think that's a result of his speech? But also the question of, because he had a different scenario, which is that Kasich runs as a favorite son and wins Ohio, and Rubio runs as a favorite son and wins Florida. The other guys aren't participating in that. In fact, Cruz is going out of his way to campaign in Florida to try to knock Rubio out, even if that means Trump wins Florida. So we'll talk to him about that. And also about this question which you raised, Tucker, which is this the establishment trying to impose its will on Republican voters? But we got another guest, too. Do you want to say who that is?
Oh, big one.
Rush Limbaugh. We don't get to see him on TV very often.
No, we don't.
All right. So one of the most amazing things out of this is, you know, Romney gets up and attacks in very pointed and very specific terms. Trump is a liar. Trump will not follow through on what he says he will. He's a con artist. And then he's saying, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it to save the party. And then he admits, I think it was yesterday, that he would be available if they wanted to nominate him as the presidential candidate. Now, Mitt Romney is a failed one-term Massachusetts governor. That's all he's ever done. He ran for senator. from Massachusetts, and he lost. And then he has run for president three times, I think, two or three times. He got the nomination last time, and he failed. And he failed specifically because he refused to hit harder against Obama. And I don't see how is he going to beat Hillary. Now, let me ask you this. Let's just say they have a contested convention, and he gets the nomination and he loses again. Would that surprise you? And that would be better than Trump winning? I don't get this. I think Mitt Romney is just here for himself. He sees an opportunity. I don't think he's a nice guy. I think he's a terrible person to put the country through what it's been through. And if not for Romney, would we even have Obamacare? Because this guy, John Gruber, that was notorious for saying that you basically had to lie to people to get him to accept Obamacare. He was the chief architect of Obamacare for the president, was the chief architect of Romney Care. There's one person connecting those two. Anyway, here's a little bit on how would a brokered GOP convention work.
I'd rather see someone besides Donald Trump become the nominee outright on the first ballot.
But what if he?
But if that doesn't happen, if that doesn't happen, then I'd like to see a open convention.
We go to a brokered convention, and the D.C. power brokers will drop someone in who is exactly to the liking of the Washington establishment. If that would happen, we will have a manifest revolt on our hands all across this country.
Well, Republicans from this election and last have mixed feelings over whether a brokered convention would be a good idea to prevent Donald Trump from gaining the nomination. So what are the odds that it happens, and how would it work?
Joining us now is a man who's watched American politics for many decades. Larry Sabato is the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and he joins us live from Charles Hill this morning. Larry, they can't have a brokered convention. I mean, there's no one to broker it, and it contravenes democracy, right?
Yeah, well, that's why I call it a contested convention, not a brokered convention. I mean, if they did have a brokered convention, I hope they take applications, because I would apply and you would, too, to be a broker. I think at the very least it would result in an ambassadorship to a warm country.
What?
I take that. There just aren't. We don't have brokers anymore. Who would do this?
I know.
Who isn't tainted by one candidate or another, or one ideology or another? There's no one, quote, universally respected in this very divisive context.
But is it possible that Donald Trump does not get the magic number of delegates at 1,237?
Yes, it's possible. So, I don't think it's probable, but it is very possible. It is more possible this year than in any year since the last truly brokered convention, which was on the Republican side in 1948, which produced Thomas E. Dewey, who lost the general election. But look, if it did happen, to get back to Tucker's second question, suppose Donald Trump gets 1,100 delegates. He's short of the 1,237. What do you think is going to happen in Cleveland if he is denied the nomination and somehow, some way that has never been explained, all of the other delegates are going to be able to unite behind some other candidate? Well, number one, you're going to have a great number of the Trump delegates walk out. And number two, I'm old enough to remember 1968 Chicago. I was actually in Chicago the week before that convention, and I remember it was an armed camp. I really think that there is the potential for some unpleasant things to happen, and I'm going to leave it that general.
Well, I completely agree with that. I mean, every point – you made a bunch of smart points, but also with respect, they're kind of obvious points. So all the geniuses who are calling for more chaos in this process and will somehow figure it out in Ohio in July, what exactly are they thinking?
Well, they're thinking exactly one thing. They do not want Donald Trump.
Right.
They're willing to do absolutely anything to make sure that he is not the nominee. You know, Tucker, I think in their own minds, they have already conceded the presidential race. They're either going to get another, quote, Republican, real Republican nominee for the GOP by dislodging Trump, or Trump will get the Republican nomination, and then almost inevitably there will be an independent, quote, real Republican ticket. And that guarantees,
wow,
Hillary's election. It does do one thing for the Republicans. It probably saves the Senate for the Republicans and the House.
I'd love to know if that candidate
will create a
runoff
of millions of additional Republican votes that will vote for the congressional nominees.
Because the promise that all the candidates took was to back whoever the front runner was, whoever won the nomination. And
but you run as a third party candidate.
Promises are operative on the day they're made. They have to be renewed daily. You know that.
It's amazing.
Well, I mean, it's a stunning turn of events, but if Larry Sabato is correct, and he makes his living off of political forecasting and explanations, you're not going to see a Republican president because either they find somebody else to replace Trump, and then that destroys the unity of the party for 2016, or Trump goes in, and then they run somebody else just to make sure that he can't win. Now, do you think that's fair? Is there something so evil about Donald Trump that he has to be killed off? Does the Republican Party think that it's going to win some purity contest by staying out of the White House for term after term? I mean, who are they kidding? The Republican Party is broken. They don't even stand for conservatism anymore. And now they're going to go take their ball and walk away from the sand box because their person doesn't get put into the nominating process. Just totally ridiculous. This is why the GOP stinks. 731 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523 1450. We'll be back.
Amber waves of rain.
All right, so I've got a little bit from your Democrat debate, which was contentious. Here's the Bernie that people wanted to see. He's fighting back against Hillary. Is it too late?
It was in one of my first years in Congress. I went to a meeting downtown in Washington, D.C., and I went there with another congressman, an African-American congressman. And then we kind of traded during the meeting. And then I saw him out later on, and he was sitting there waiting, and I said, well, let's go and get a cab. How come you didn't go out and get a cab? He said, no, I don't get cabs in Washington, D.C. It was about 20 years ago. Because he was humiliated by the fact that cab drivers would go past them because he was black. I couldn't believe, you know, you just sit there and you say, this man did not take a cab 20 years ago in Washington, D.C. Tell you another story. I was with some young people active in the Black Lives Matter movement. Young lady comes up to me and she says, you don't understand what police do in certain black communities. You don't understand the degree to which we are terrorized. And I'm not just shooting, I'm not just talking about the horrible shootings that we have seen, which have got to end, and we've got to hold police officers accountable. I'm just talking about everyday activities where police officers are bullying people. So what, to answer your question, I would say, and I think it's similar to what the secretary said, when you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be...
Black Lives Matter, baby. All right, Hillary... All right, here is Bernie shutting down Hillary. Check it out.
Well, I'll tell you something else that Senator Sanders was against. He was against the auto bailout. In January of 2009, President-elect Obama asked everybody in the Congress to vote for the bailout. The money was there and had to be released in order to save the American auto industry and 4 million jobs and to begin the restructuring. We just had the best year that the auto industry has had in a long time. I voted to save the auto industry. He voted against the money that ended up saving the auto industry. Whoa. I think that is a pretty big difference.
Well, I said... If you are talking about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy,
you know.
So, excuse me, I'm talking.
Let him run.
If you're going to talk, tell the whole story, Senator.
Let
Sanders.
Me tell my story, you tell yours.
I will.
Your story is for voting for every disastrous trade agreement and voting for corporate America. Did I vote against the Wall Street bailout? When billionaires on Wall Street destroyed this economy, they went to Congress and they said, oh, please, we'll be good boys, bail us out. You know what I said? I said, let the billionaires themselves bail out Wall Street. Shouldn't be the middle class of this country.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Wait, can I finish? You'll have your turn. All right. But ultimately, if you look at our records, I stood up to corporate America time and time again. I went to Mexico. I saw the lives of people.
All right, so he shut down Hillary. We'll take a break right here and come back. And I've got some more interesting news about Glenn Beck, who's being investigated by the feds for a supposed threat against Donald Trump. Yeah, Glenn Beck has just become totally unhinged. 738, Kelly O'Connell Show, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523, 1450. We'll be right back.
Majesties.
Bernie Sanders shuts up Hillary. Unbelievable, huh? Who could shut up the great Hillary? But check this out.
Destroyed this economy.
You know.
So, excuse me, I'm talking.
Let him run.
If you're going to talk, tell the whole story, Senator
Let
Sanders.
Me tell my story, you tell yours.
I will.
Your story is for voting for every disastrous trade agreement and voting...
You know, Hillary must have one of the worst speaking voices I've ever heard. It just sounds like I'm trying to think of what I would compare it to. It sounds like a construction worker after a weekend on a crack pipe. All right, so Glenn Beck, feds investigate Glenn Beck for Trump threat, but he also said this about. This was said to George Stephanopoulos on ABC this week. Trump is a Hitler
Trump camp. But if you listen to those callers, it sounds like the GOP splits no matter what, but there's no bridging this divide.
The GOP has one last chance to listen to the people. And the people that, and I understand it, they're very, very angry because the GOP did not listen the first time around. They didn't listen to the Ron Paul people who are way ahead of the curve, then the Tea Party people, and they rubbed our nose in it. And they are tired, and they have created Donald Trump. The people are speaking clearly, and there's two ways to go: anger and nationalism, which has been done before in history.
Whoa!
And
hey,
you
Kelly,
can go for nationalism, you can go for anger.
Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler.
If you look at what's happening with Donald Trump and his playing to the lowest common denominator and to the anger in us, you know, Adolf Hitler. We all look at Adolf Hitler in 1940. We should look at Adolf Hitler in 1929. He was a kind of a funny kind of character that said the things that people were thinking. Where Donald Trump takes it, I have absolutely no idea. But Donald Trump is a dangerous man with the things that he has been saying. Now, the GOP is playing unbelievable games right now, trying to make sure they get their way. And they're trying to go for a brokered convention. I'm against Donald Trump. But I'll tell you one thing, if he gets close enough and the GOP tries to play games, I won't vote for Donald Trump ever, but I will stand with his right because the people have spoken. And what the GOP is doing is they are stirring things up because they are more afraid of Ted Cruz than they are of Donald Trump.
And you're supporting Ted Cruz. How does Ted Cruz?
All right, so he's standing for Donald Trump to support Ted Cruz. Is that it? We've got a phone call. Thank you. All right, guys, listen. Please, please, if you call in and I ask you if I'm playing a clip, there's a speaker on my, I have a console that everything goes through. If I'm playing a clip, that music or the clip or whatever is coming through the console, that same speaker is where the phone call comes in for me. I don't hear it through my earphones. I hear it through this little speaker. So be that as, you know, it may be primitive. It's not a multi-million-dollar studio, but it is actually a pretty nice studio, and it has a lot of money invested in it. But if you call in and there's a clip, I can't really talk to you while the clip is going on. So if I ask you if I can put you on hold, just be on hold for a minute. I know it's, you know, frustrating, but anyway. All right. Feds investigate Glenn Beck for Trump threat, and he said that he would repeatedly stab Donald Trump, even though he's standing up for his right as a candidate. Check this out. And this is from
Vote for Donald Trump.
This is from the Daily Caller.
Would you vote for Donald Trump if he is the nominee? And last night, I know how I would have answered this, but I don't know the right way to answer that at CPAC, at the debate last night.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, but I think they all answered it improperly.
Yeah, I do too. The answer is no. And you know why? Because I care a hell of a lot more about the country than I do the stupid Republican Party. The end. I will not support him as a nominee.
I agree with you. I think the only one that had an okay answer was Ted, because he made it on. I gave you my word, and I'm not going to go back on my word. I think that was an okay answer. Everybody else was about the party. His was about his word. But I don't know what I would have done if I were sitting in their shoes. I can't say it that way. If I were on the stage, I would have said, have you been listening to him tonight?
Right.
Have you been listening to what I say about him? I believe these things. Shoes.
Yeah, I'm yeah. not going to be...
Sitting.
Would
you
be weird.
Sit in their shoes. I mean, would you have gigantic shoes?
How would if I were close enough and I had a knife? Really, I mean, the stabbing just wouldn't stop.
All right, so he's being investigated by the feds for saying that if he was on the stage with Trump and had a knife, the stabbing wouldn't stop. So I think that is taking it too far personally. But all right, so... Here's the issue that it is. We've got this amazing thing going on. Donald Trump starts off in the race and nobody takes him seriously. Everybody says he's a joke. He gets more and more support. The support goes on. He starts polling better and better, and people start to like what they hear him talking about. sending people back to Mexico, keeping Muslims from flying in the country, things that some individuals consider to be common sense, others consider to be xenophobic and hateful. So right away, the things that he did captured people's attention, imagination, or their fury. And you couldn't avoid him. He's the only person who was talking about repatriating illegals or blocking Muslims from coming into the country, etc. He got a lot of support from certain people. Now, time has passed. There were 15 candidates. There's now four. Two of those candidates are not viable. As far as I can tell, Rubio and Kasich will have to go away at some point, leaving Cruz. So the question is, here's a couple of questions for you. Number one, if Cruz ends up winning, will they try a brokered convention? Because everybody hates his guts. And most people agree that in some way he's more radical than Donald, in some ways. Now, if Trump gets it, they've already said that they're going to, you've got Mitt Romney, the last candidate that stood up and said in a speech that he was a terrible person. And, you know, Romney has put himself out there. He initially said, this is not about me. And now it turns out it is about him because he would take the nomination. So the upshot is that we've now found out that there is a plan to bring in a third party candidate, a third party GOP candidate, a conservative candidate or whatever. They either force Trump out, they either get Trump to lose, or they force him out and bring in another candidate. And if they can't do that, if he runs, then they run another candidate. And that's the Death Star option, right? The Republican Party is too important for America. It's got to be kept pure, right? Whatever the purity looks like. We're either going to have our candidate, or we're going to kill all of the GOP candidates and hand the nomination, the presidency over to Hillary, unless she gets indicted. She's under investigation by the FBI right now. And then Sanders takes over. So is the GOP justified in doing this? Let's come back and talk about that. We'll be right back. 749, 750 on the money. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523, 1450. We'll be right back.
I'm talking about America. Sweet America. You know, God done shake his grace on me.
It is 7:53. It's pretty nice outside right now, and I've got I've got a little clip here for you from Limbaugh from Fox News. 44 degrees right now. Now, the question that I ask you is, in all possible universes, is it better for Hillary to be president than Trump or any other GOP candidate? Why have a party to commit suicide? And when you don't even know what kind of a president Trump will be. I mean, to me, this is the crazy thing. They're not working with this guy. They're not trying to teach him about some of the fine parts of conservatism, try to persuade him. They're just saying he's going to be a bad candidate, even though we promised we'd support whoever was elected, even though we promised that if he, you know, pledged himself to not go third party, then we would support whoever won. He is full of liars, I guess. Anyway, here, check this out with Limbaugh. Very fascinating interview.
Okay.
Let's go. Let's start with Mitt Romney's speech this week, in which he basically joined the anybody but Trump movement. You say that that is going to backfire with Trump supporters, and other voters are going to see it as the establishment trying to tell them what to do. With Mitt Romney listening, explain what he's missing.
Well, it's all that and more, but and it's not unprecedented. His dad did much the same thing against Barry Goldwater with a cabal of Republican establishment guys back in 1964. The establishment, this isn't new. The establishment not wanting outsiders, not wanting conservatives, isn't anything new. Now, Chris, very briefly, I think there's something remarkable happening here that nobody's talked about. They're skirting the issue. For the longest time, the Republican Party has told us that they can't win with just Republican votes. And that's why they support amnesty. That's why they support the Democrats on many of their issues to go out and get Hispanics or other minorities. Well, guess who's doing it? Donald Trump is doing it. Donald Trump has put together a coalition, whether he knows it or not, whether he intended to or not. He's put together a coalition that's exactly what the Republican Party says that it needs to win. And yet, look what they're doing. They're trying to get Trump out of the race because they're not in charge of it. They're not in control of it. And it's the most amazing thing to watch this happen. Governor Romney comes along and tries to talk people out of Trump, and that's not going to work. You can't talk his supporters out of supporting him. But the only guy that's going to be able to do that is Trump himself.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, because there is a lot of commentary, and some of it coming from conservatives, who say that the Republican Party is in danger of tearing itself apart. We've seen splits many times before over political philosophy, but that's not what's happening this time. This is the establishment, the elite of the party versus the grassroots base.
Exactly. But it really isn't anything new. They were this way with Ronald Reagan before Reagan was elected. Tried to deny Reagan in 76, and they tried to deny Reagan in 1980. They're not conservative. This is, you know, when I hear Governor Romney in his speech last week talk about how the Republican Party must stand for legitimate conservative values, they don't. That's why they're in the problem. They're having the problem they're having. They're not conservative. They're being run by their donors. You look at these primaries so far, do you realize they don't like Cruz either, Chris? In fact, maybe they dislike Cruz more than Trump. But Cruz and Trump are the only guys that have won anything. The establishment candidates in this race cannot get noticed. The Republican primary voters, whether they're closed primaries or open, are voting for anybody but candidates attached to the Republican establishment.
I know that you think that Ted Cruz is the real conservative in this race, and we'll discuss him in a moment. But let's talk about Donald Trump first. How would you feel? You talked about him bringing new people into the party. How would you feel if he ends up as the Republican nominee for president?
Well, I would feel much the way that I feel when anybody is elected. It could be you deal with what you end up getting. I'm not under any illusion, Chris, that I have any ultimate say-so in this. I'm like anybody else that's in media. I've got my opinions. I share them. I'm not afraid of them. But you don't win everything. And ultimately, you have to take what you get. I think with the case of Trump, there's a much bigger upside than downside.
Much bigger upside than downside.
A lot of people disagree with me on this, but
here's the thing. Will Trump be across the board conservative? No. Is he going to be more conservative than Hillary Clinton? Obviously. Or Bernie Sanders, especially, obviously. Is he going to be a better leader? Is he going to fight for us? He's going to stand up for the open borders and everything. For the GOP to just hand this to decide that it's the Death Star model, we either stop Trump or we destroy everything, is the craziest thing I've ever heard. It is sickening. They're just giving up on their responsibility, and they're going to destroy the party itself. Anyway, my prediction, Kelly O'Connell, thanks for listening in. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. Have a great day. We'll see you back in 22 hours. Ciao. And thanks to Nancy Reagan for her service to this country.
Save it, brotherhood, from